We're about to take another extended journey through the Old Testament this morning. We're going to be, we're going to be everywhere from Deuteronomy to Ezra in one sermon. I know what you're thinking. I thought we were in the book of Esther. We are. But believe it or not, last Sunday's 55-minute sermon was not enough to fully set the context for the story of Esther. So there's so much more we need to understand, and I hope to finish that today. But first, we got to finish where we left off last week. So open your Bibles. We're going to jump right into it. By the way, I promise we're not going to do this every week of the series, where we just do massive history and maps and timelines. We'll build the foundation over a couple of weeks, and then we will not wear you out each and every week. But this is going to be a long one again today, but I think an important one. All right, Esther, chapter 1, verse 13. We're going to go through chapter 2, verse 8, and introduce our main characters. By the way, if you missed last Sunday's message, you've got to go back and listen to it on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, on YouTube, whatever you have, because that is so critical to understanding this entire book. And I'm not going to have time to recap all the details today. Also, several of you asked for the slides from last week. And I understand why, because I was constantly pointing to visuals, and I'm sure it's frustrating to listen to the message and go, what is he talking about? So my hope is to get those uploaded onto the resources tab on Church Center under All Church sometime today or tomorrow, and also to maybe upload the slides from this morning's sermon as well. So watch for those. Okay, we abruptly quit last week at verse 12. So we're going to pick up there. Let me first remind you what happened in these first 12 verses. We read about three banquets that took place in the third year of the reign of King Xerxes, who is the king of the Medes and the Persians. That would be the year 483 BC. Three banquets were held in the city of Susa at his winter palace in that year. The first lasted for how long? 180 days, 6 months of partying and talking and planning. And we looked at that and we said, probably what's going on there is Xerxes was meeting with his nobles and his army officers for war planning, because he is planning this audacious invasion of Greece. And so he needed to spend a considerable amount of time, up to 6 months, doing that planning for that, launching that invasion. But then we see a second banquet, and this one lasts only 7 days. How many of you guys have held a seven-day party? Only 7 days. And it is for all the men present there in the palace, including the nobles and princes of the kingdom. And it appears simultaneously his wife, Queen Vashti, is also holding her own banquet at the palace, that one for the noble women of the kingdom. So you've got these things happening at the same time. Now, as I shared last week, the book of Esther is a book of crisis. It moves from one situation to another, one crisis to another. And last week we saw the first crisis popped to the surface. It happens in verses 10 through 12 on the seventh day of Xerxes' banquet, when he is at least mildly drunk. He turns to his eunuchs, his servants, and he snaps his fingers and he asks for what? Go get my wife, the queen, drag her out. No, I didn't say drag her. Bring her out before me and all of these men so that we can see her what? Her beauty, that she would display her beauty. Now, we're not told specifically why the king requested this, what prompted it, but it seems logical to assume what we know about Xerxes and his ego. He wanted to boast in how good his life was as the king, and what better way than to say, look how beautiful my wife is. So Vashti is ordered to appear and ordered to look her best in front of all these men who, yes, have been feasting and drinking for 7 days. Now, that would make any woman in any culture at any time period extremely nervous and uncomfortable. But as I said last week, Vashti's job in that moment was to what? Obey. This is the ancient Near East. This is what she was to obey, to publicly display her royal beauty in order to glorify her king and her husband. That's what she needed to do. But in verse 12, we're told that the queen refuses the king's command. Let me say that again. She refused the king's command, which was a bold and risky move, right? She had to know that she was putting not just her crown, but possibly her life at risk, because that choice was a public defiance of royalty. Public. And for a young king like Xerxes, we looked at that. He's at this point about 35 years old. He's trying to prove himself to all the noble princes of the kingdom. This is a public embarrassment. He looks weak in front of these men. But there's a great irony in this. And maybe you noticed it last week. Here's the most powerful man on earth. He commands armies and conquers nations, but there's one seemingly simple thing he can't do. He can't control his wife. He cannot command his wife to obey him. And so in verse 12, we read the obvious. The king is furious, right? That's where we left off. Now, before we go on, this is a good time to pause in the story and point out something that's very important. And this will be true the rest of this series. In the world of biblical genres, the book of Esther is what we call historical narrative. And historical narrative can be tricky to interpret because they're notorious for leaving out details that we as readers wish we had. They're just not given to us, right? For example, we'd like to know precisely what was it that motivated Xerxes to call his wife out, to display herself. And we'd love to know precisely why Vashti refused, but those details aren't given to us. Those details would help us to define these two characters in a moral sense, but the author, for whatever reason, doesn't give them to us. Because here's the thing, sometimes the author of a historical narrative is more interested in the situation than he is in the motivation of the characters, and that seems to be the case here. The author just doesn't take the time to tell us why these decisions were made, but we're going to find out in just a moment what those decisions led to. And that is what the author wants us to note here. So it can be fun to step back from a story like this and speculate about motivations and decisions of the characters. And we can look at culture and context. That's all fine. But we have to be careful not to get too dogmatic and say this is absolutely what's going on unless the text itself explicitly tells us what's going on. Does that make sense? Okay, so I'll try to make that clear when we're speculating or this is possible, but we're not going to be dogmatic about everything. So beginning in verse 13, the story moves past why Vashti refused the king's command to the question of how her insubordination is now going to be handled by the king. Verse 13, then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king so to speak before all who knew law and justice and were close to him. And he gives the names, Karshanah, Shethar, Admathah, Tarshish, Meris, Marsanah, Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. These are important men, aren't they? Very important men. Verse 15, according to law, the king asks, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus, delivered by the eunuchs. So this actually shows a little bit of wisdom, doesn't it? A little bit of patience on the part of Xerxes. He's angry, and yet he doesn't pronounce some hasty judgment. He turns to his nobles, these important men, and he asks them for legal counsel. And one of the men steps forward in verse 16. In the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, listen to this now, she is wrong, not only the king, but all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Now that's three alls, if you didn't catch that. That is a wide and sweeping indictment. Now listen to his reasoning and keep in mind that Vashti was the most prominent and visible woman in the kingdom. Verse 17, for the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought to his presence, but she did not come. This day, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. You can almost hear the fear in this guy's voice, right? Like, he's nervous. What if all of our wives start refusing us in our homes? It's chaos. And what's going to happen? We're all going to be angry. Everybody's going to be grumpy in the whole kingdom. It's actually kind of humorous, isn't it? Again, this is the most powerful empire in the world, and they've got this silly problem, don't they? Verse 19, he goes on. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, listen, so that it cannot be repealed, that's important, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. In other words, don't let us down, king. This insubordination has to be dealt with firmly and harshly. Make sure that every wife understands she cannot disobey her husband and get away with it. Now, this is what is going to open the door to what the author is really concerned about. How this insubordination opens up the position of queen for Xerxes, right? And what the king is going to look for is someone who is more worthy than Vashti, meaning what? More submissive than Vashti. And then Momukan wraps up his logic in verse 20. When the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all of his kingdom, great as it is, O great king, right? Butter up the king. Then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. And this word pleased the king and the princes. Of course it did. Of course it did. And the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, right? Because it's a vast kingdom of multiple languages. That every man should be the master in his own house and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. So this is an obvious sign. Husbands, take control of your households, and wives, remain in submission. And as I read this, I find this so interesting because, again, we're talking about 2,500 years ago in the ancient Near East. You would not think there would be even a hint of proto-feminism at that time, in that place. You know, wives that were pushing back against the patriarchy of that day. But we should not forget what happened in the garden, right? In Genesis 3:16, part of the curse given to the woman was, your desire will be for your husband's role, but he will rule over you. And that struggle was still happening in Persia in the 5th century BC. Now, how many of you are grateful for how the New Testament picks up on this and gives us a very clear and balanced view of this issue of leadership and submission in marriage? Raise your hand. Are you grateful? I am. While the wife in the New Testament is called to be subject to her husband and to show him respect, simultaneously, the husband is called to love and cherish his wife as Christ loves his bride, the church. That is an incredibly high calling. And to live with her in an understanding way. And when both husband and wife live out those commands, not demanding the other fulfill their role, but focusing on what God has commanded them to do, doing that at the same time, well, then marriage is beautiful, isn't it? It's beautiful. But these are obviously things that Xerxes and these nobles had no clue about. What they want are wives that will simply cower and obey. Okay, so now the stage is set with those ironic, funny, kind of scary stories of three banquets. We now get the introduction of our main characters. Turn over to chapter 2. Now, let's start with a historical note. Drop your eyes in chapter 2 down to verse 16, and in the very end of the sentence, you will see that the events of chapter 2 take place in the 7th year of Xerxes' reign. Here's what that means. Between chapter 1 and chapter 2, we're jumping ahead 4 years. 4 years. That's important to know. And during that time, during those 4 years, what happened? Xerxes did launch this invasion of Greece in the year 480 BC. We know this historically. He launched this invasion, and as I explained last Sunday, he had some initial success. He actually sacked the city of Athens and burned it and felt like, oh, I got some revenge for my father having been defeated by the Athenians, but ultimately, he lost the battle. His armies were pushed out of Greece. So as we come to chapter 2 now, Xerxes is back in Persia, and he is licking his wounds from this loss, which, again, must have been humiliating before his fellow nobles. Now he's seeking to cheer his heart through other means. So look at chapter 2. After these things, that's sort of the author's way of saying time advanced, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Now, interestingly, the Jewish historian Josephus, in his work, The Antiquities of the Jews, he writes that, at least in his day, the Jewish community believed that Xerxes was still in love with Vashti, and he grieved over the fact that he had to separate from her, but he felt bound to the law. He decreed it. Remember, it said the law cannot be repealed. He had decreed it, and so it must be so. What that means is we have a deeply unhappy king. He's licking his wounds from a loss on the battlefield, and he's missing his queen, and there is nothing worse than an unhappy, unstable king, especially for the servants. And so they cook up a plan to help Xerxes get out of this funk. Verse 2, then the king's attendants who served him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, and into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. And, not surprisingly, this matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. So, good news. We're going to hold a Miss Persian Empire pageant. That's what's going to happen. We're going to parade this endless number of beautiful women before the king. By the way, Herodotus says it was more than 400 women, ultimately, that came before the king. And whichever young lady he fancies the most, she'll be the queen. And the servants think this is going to keep the king busy and happy for quite a while. And finally, here in verse 7, we're now introduced to our main characters. And then we'll stop here and do some historical work. Verse 5, now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, remember that lineage there. That's important. Who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. Love those two verses, just chock full of history, which we'll break down. Verse 7, he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. And I actually had to Google that. What does that mean? It's basically an older cousin, right? Am I right? Your uncle's daughter? Okay, it's an older cousin. I mean, I had to look that up. That was so confusing. I don't know why. My pea brain just couldn't process it. Okay. So he's bringing up Esther, his younger cousin, for she had no father or mother. Now, the young lady was beautiful of form and face. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Okay. So here's the controversial question of the day. How did we get here? How does a man of Judah from the tribe of Benjamin end up living in a royal Persian city like Susa, and what does that say about his identity and about his faith as a Jew? Those are the questions we want to answer today. And so to do that, we're going to go back to the Torah, and we're going to talk about the roots of the Babylonian exile. I want to take you back to the fifth book of the Old Testament, the book of Deuteronomy, and I want you to think about what's the most famous chapter in Deuteronomy. Every biblical student knows this answer to that question. If you want to look at the future of Israel, the most famous chapter is Deuteronomy 28. In Deuteronomy 28, that is where, now this is written 1,000 years before the story of Esther. In that chapter, Yahweh establishes through Moses a conditional covenant with his people Israel. And he promises them what? Future blessings if they obey, and future curses for idolatry and disobedience. It's very simple. And among the promised blessings in that chapter are prosperity and security in the land, right? And they're about to go into the land under the leadership of Joshua. And God says to Moses, if I give you the land and you continue to obey me, you will be blessed in every way. But, and by the way, that'll be a promised land flowing with milk and honey. It'll be great, but it's conditional. But, he says, it shall come about if you do not obey the Lord your God to observe all of his commandments and his statutes with which I charge you today, that all of these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Now, if you were an Israelite at this moment, would your ears perk up and go, oh, I should be careful about these things, because the word cursing from Yahweh is a bad thing, right? And it goes on. One of the sections of this chapter says this: The Lord shall cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You will go out one way against them, but you will flee seven ways before them, and you will be an example of terror or horror to all the kingdoms of the earth. That's just one among a whole list of curses. Look at that again. You will be defeated by your enemies. You'll go out one way to fight them, but you'll flee seven ways away from them. Now, what does that mean exactly? Well, there's an interesting history behind this, a history of Bible translation. Look at the last phrase. You will be an example of terror or horror to the kingdoms of the earth. The Hebrew word there for terror is za'ava, and it's meant to convey this meaning. This is important. That when Israel disobeys the Lord and he punishes them by using invasion from foreigners and then exile to foreign lands, the point is they will become an example of humiliation for all the nations to see. And as the nations look at the people of Yahweh and realize that Yahweh himself has punished them for their disobedience, the conclusion of the nations will be, ah, Yahweh should be obeyed. That's the whole point. Israel will get, remember this, Israel was given every advantage in knowing the God of creation. Every advantage, the patriarchs, the covenants, the law, the prophets, and more. But with great advantage comes great responsibility. And the promise in Scripture is that judgment always starts in the household of God, right? God looks first and foremost at his people when they disobey. And by the way, it'd be wise for us to remember that, right? Because he disciplines those that he calls his own when we sin against him. And with Israel's repeated cycle of spiritual adultery, the ramifications are very, very severe. Now, here's the interesting twist in the story of this verse in Deuteronomy 28. In the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, that last sentence reads a bit differently. Here's what it says in the Septuagint. You will flee seven ways before them, and you will be a dispersion among the nations of the earth. So the translators use the word diaspora there for za'ava. And the question is often asked, why? Well, the Septuagint is translated in the 3rd century BC, and that word at the time reflected what the translator saw happening in the world. Yes, the Jews had been disobedient, and yes, God had been faithful to punish them just as he had promised. He had taken them out of the promised land and dispersed them, scattered them across the world, and Mordecai and Esther are part of that dispersion. So when you look at biblical history and you look at intertestamental history, you see that historically, the Jews were dispersed in a series of stages because of their repeated cycles of sin. I'm going to give you some timelines here. It starts in 722 BC, right? The Assyrian destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel are deported out of the land. And they go through a process of ethnic cleansing at the hands of the Assyrians, essentially disappearing 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel. You talk about a dispersion, it's even worse than that. They essentially ethnically disappear. Then the fall of the southern kingdom in 586 at the hands of the Babylonians, right? Three waves of deportation to Babylon. And it's in Babylon that we find the first true diaspora community outside the promised land. And it's in Babylon during 70 years, the Jews as a diaspora now have to start building synagogues, not to replace the temple, because you can't replace the temple, you can't do sacrifices anywhere else, but the synagogue gave the community a chance to gather together, to pray, and to read Torah and Tanakh. And that was important in Babylon. And as we saw last Sunday then, in 538, Persian King Cyrus conquers Babylon and decrees that the Jews can return to their homeland, but many Jews choose not to. And we're going to dig into that more today. The majority stay in Babylon, or they move even further east into Persian lands, and many of them actually relocate to Egypt as well. And we find later during the Hellenistic period, the biggest Jewish diaspora community is in Alexandria, Egypt. Now, for the Jews who return to the land and rebuild Jerusalem and build the second temple, they have to remain under Persian rule for more than 200 more years. But after that, they fall under the power of the Greeks, first under the Ptolemies of Egypt and then under the even worse Seleucid Empire of Damascus. And so they're under Greek rule for a time. And then comes this glorious period of Jewish history, what we call the Maccabean Revolt. Great study, intertestamental period, the Jewish War of Independence. And that gave the Jews 100 years of independence from Gentile domination. But sadly, and this is the great tragedy of the Maccabean Revolt, after all that fighting for independence, the Jewish kings and queens who came to power during those 100 years, more wicked than the Gentile rulers that had ruled over them. More wicked and more corrupt. They're called the Hasmonean kings and queens. That awful period sparked an even greater punishment from God, the arrival of the Romans. And that's the critical turning point in the history of the Jewish diaspora. Roman general Pompey rolls into the promised land in the year 63 BC, and within 100 years of being under the thumb of Rome, the Jews rise up in revolution. Now, most of us know that story that takes place, and now we've turned over to AD, right? AD 70. This time, they think they've got another Maccabean victory coming, but it doesn't happen this time. There's no glorious victory. In AD 70, the Roman army sacks Jerusalem. They tear down and burn the second temple, and they either kill or carry away into slavery. Some accounts say 1 million Jews, but at least hundreds of thousands of Jews are killed in that revolt in the year AD 70. And yet, God's not done with his people. They slowly begin to filter back into the land. And then there is one final catastrophe. And this revolt is not known quite as well in the year 132 to 135, known as the Bar Kokhba revolt. Another 500,000 Jews are killed in that particular war. And from that point forward, Rome is done with the Jewish people. They expel every Jew from Jerusalem, will not allow Jews into the city. They actually rebuild the city of Jerusalem as a Roman city and rename it Aelia Capitolina. And then with the intent of poking the Jews in the eye, the Romans said, let's rename the whole region. And they said, well, who are the Jews' most famous enemy? And somebody said, the Philistines. And they said, fine, we will rename the region Palestina. Does that sound familiar? That argument is still happening today in so-called Palestine. So it's estimated that soon after the Bar Kokhba revolt, mid-second century, get this now, 80% of the Jews across the world are now living in a diaspora community outside the promised land. And those communities begin to grow in different parts of the empire, in parts of the Middle East, in North Africa, even west into European lands. And in every place the Jews go, they develop a unique culture and unique practices, and they adapt to the language issues that they're forced to deal with. And in spite of constant persecution, every place the Jews go, they are a religious minority who is under constant persecution, and yet somehow, by God's grace, they survive. Today, there are generally three categories of Jews scattered across the world, many of which have now migrated into the modern state of Israel. We have Mizrahi Jews who come from various Middle Eastern communities. Yes, Jews from Iraq and Iran and Yemen and Syria and Egypt. Sephardic Jews who originally came out of the Iberian Peninsula, which is modern-day Spain, but then spread through North Africa and the Middle East, places like Turkey and Morocco and Algeria and Tunisia and Libya. And then in today's Israel, about 25% of the population, Ashkenazi Jews, mainly from Eastern Europe, places like Poland and Russia and Germany and Ukraine and Hungary and Romania. And while there has always been a presence of some Jews in the land from the time of Joshua until today, since the Roman period, being part of a diaspora became the norm rather than the exception for the Jewish population. Until when? Until the 20th century, right? Until the Zionist movement of the early 20th century, until the Holocaust of World War II under the Nazis, and the establishment and the defense of the modern state of Israel in 1948. So catch this now. That was a very fast lesson on the diaspora. Catch that, 1,800 years of diaspora living for an ancient people whom God has sovereignly sustained and now planted back in the land. Guys, that's why 1948 was such a big deal. It had been 1,800 years. Now, I could go into all kinds of politics on that. We'll do podcasts or something like that. But that's important to understand that history, that God has been sovereignly sustaining his people Israel. So, wow, back to the curse of Deuteronomy 28. I know last week we talked briefly about the 70-year exile to Babylon, but I want to dive a little bit deeper this morning because I want to paint the picture of how Mordecai and Esther ended up in the situation they're in. How did they end up living in Persia? Well, we know that in the 6th century BC, God's patience with disobedient Judah ran out. And here's what God said through his prophet Jeremiah. The word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah in the 4th year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, the word of the Lord has come to me, and I, Jeremiah, have spoken it to you again and again, but you have not listened, nor inclined your ear to hear. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, because you've not obeyed my words, I will send to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant. Now, we saw last week how Cyrus was called my anointed servant, right? Nebuchadnezzar, similarly, is called Yahweh's servant because God has a task for him, a role for him to play, and it's an important role. He says, Nebuchadnezzar, my servant, I will bring him against this land and against its inhabitants, and I will utterly destroy them and make them a horror and a hissing. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of joy and the voice of gladness and the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones and the light of the lamp. This whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and this nation will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Deuteronomy 28, right? Consequences, the cursing. Did they deserve it? Absolutely. Had God been gracious? Absolutely. But the patience had run out. Now you could say, this sounds really harsh, but the ground rules had been laid out. And it's not as if God hadn't sent prophet after prophet to the Jewish people to warn them. But in every case, they were ignored. And at this point, the consequences of Deuteronomy 28 are brought to bear upon both the people and the land. Now, most of the people of Judah who weren't killed in the invasion were carried off to Babylon as captives. And that's a process we talked briefly about last week. It happened in 3 waves. We have a first wave in 605 BC during the reign of Jehoiakim. This was a time when Judah was a vassal state to Babylon. What that means is we pay you money to leave us alone. We pay you money every year so you don't smash us like a bug. And Jehoiakim made the foolish mistake of rebelling against his overlords. And so General Nebuchadnezzar at the time said, fine, I'm coming with my army. And he came to the promised land, and he could have wiped them out in 605, but something happened while he was invading Israel. His father, the king of Babylon, died. And so Nebuchadnezzar had to go back to Babylon and secure his seat on the throne. But before he left, he captured Jehoiakim, and he took back to Babylon some of the treasure from Israel, and he took the best and brightest of the young Jewish men at that time, including who? Including Daniel and his 3 friends. That happens in 605. Now you think, why would God allow that? Why would God allow his best and brightest to be taken away? Well, it turns out it's a grace for his people. Because of Daniel's presence in Babylon, the exile the Jews are going to suffer through is not nearly as bad as it could have been. Because by the time Judah is completely wiped out and all the people are brought into captivity, Daniel has become the second most important man in the entire empire. And he's able to bless the people and actually give them prosperity in the land. So Daniel in Babylon becomes similar to Joseph in Egypt, a gift of mercy from God to his people, even in the midst of hardship. That's important to know. Then we have a second attack in 597 for the same reason. The next king, Jehoiakim, also rebels against Babylon, refuses to pay the annual tribute to them. And so Nebuchadnezzar says, fine, I'm coming back and I will punish you again. And this time he takes back with him 10,000 Jewish captives, including the prophet Ezekiel. And in one of his visions in Babylon, which you can read about in Ezekiel chapters 10 and 11, Ezekiel describes how the glory of the Lord departs from the temple in Jerusalem. Why? because of the sin of the people, and because the temple's about to be destroyed. In anticipation of its destruction, the glory of the Lord leaves the temple. And that happens in 586. The new king of Judah, who, by the way, Nebuchadnezzar had personally put on the throne, Zedekiah, as a puppet ruler. Nebuchadnezzar didn't want to destroy Jerusalem, but he puts this guy on the throne and says, now be a good puppet. And within months, I mean, the foolishness, it's only supernatural. The foolishness is so bad. Within months, Zedekiah is doing the same thing, rebelling against the Babylonians. And so in 586, Nebuchadnezzar says, that's it. He rolls into town. This time he destroys Jerusalem. He levels Solomon's temple. Think about that. And he carries off the majority of the population into exile. Who does he leave behind? Only the poorest people, only the least valuable people. Everybody else he takes away. Interesting story about Zedekiah. He tries to flee. He's the one who caused this whole thing. He tries to flee the city at night to escape punishment, but he's caught in the plains of Jericho and he's brought to King Nebuchadnezzar. And do you remember the story? Nebuchadnezzar executes his two sons right before his eyes and then puts Zedekiah's eyes out so that the last thing he sees in life was the death of his sons and takes him away in chains. By the way, today, if you go to Israel, you can actually watch. These are called Zedekiah's Cave. It's one of the least known things in Jerusalem that you can tour. This is the act. They have actually marked out the path that Zedekiah took under the city of Jerusalem. You go right under the Temple Mount in order to try to escape the city. It's an amazing place. So if you ever go to Israel, go to Zedekiah's Cave. So the curse of Deuteronomy 28 is laid upon the people. You have to understand the tragedy involved here in 586, you guys. Remember, the northern kingdom is gone. Now the southern kingdom is gone. There is no Israelite kingdom in God's promised land. There is no temple. There is no place for sacrifice. This is the greatest national tragedy in the history of Israel. In fact, I think it's today. Tisha B'Av is being celebrated in Israel today. This is a national mourning over the loss of their temple. I didn't even plan that, but it's actually happening on August 3rd this year. Psalm 137 sort of sums up the feelings of the people. In Psalm 137, it says, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps, for there our captors demanded of us songs, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. You hear the dripping sarcasm. The Babylonians say, hey, Jew, sing me a song. Sing me one of your songs. And it says, how can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? That's the state of mind in 586. Now, had God left his people? No, the promise remains, right? He had not left his people. He's still at work. He's still speaking through his prophets. Remember, Jeremiah had given the people this faithful hope, 70 years in captivity, only 70 years. And then God had Daniel working inside the Babylonian government, prophesying. Sing to the people. He had Ezekiel out in the fields with the common people, giving him visions, prophesying, encouraging the people. And all three of those men were subtle reminders that in spite of what the Jews saw with their eyes, Yahweh had not abandoned them. Yahweh was still at work. The Babylonians aren't actually in charge. Yahweh is. And he would soon rescue his people. Now, I won't go into the details. We talked about it last Sunday. This is the moment where God raises up Cyrus the Great, king of the Medes and the Persians. And he's going to use this man to free his people. In 539 BC, Cyrus's army takes the city of Babylon. This great kingdom that Nebuchadnezzar had built after his death, it falls hard. And Ezra now picks up the story. I'm going to give you some of Ezra. Ezra chapter 1. This is how he describes the decree of Cyrus that we looked at last week. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah. You see the connection? Jeremiah said 70 years. God raises up Cyrus and says, this is the fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all this kingdom and also put it in writing. So who's responsible for this? Is it Cyrus or is it Yahweh? God providentially stirs the heart of this pagan man to rescue his people. Amazing. What does the decree say? Thus says Cyrus, the king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he's appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Now, it's tempting to read that and go, oh, Cyrus was a believer. He was a follower of Yahweh, but don't be fooled. This is typical of ancient Near East kings. They're polytheists. They want every single god of the ancient Near East to bless them. So he honestly, Cyrus thinks by doing this, he's somehow going to win Yahweh's favor as much as he wins the favor of Bel and Marduk and all these other gods. So don't be fooled by this. Cyrus is fishing for the blessing of Yahweh, even though he doesn't know Yahweh at all. Remember, Isaiah last week made that plain. And yet God calls Cyrus his anointed servant to accomplish all that Yahweh wants to accomplish. This is the sovereignty of God in human history. So what happens next after this Cyrus decree is issued? Ezra continues. Then the heads of fathers' households of Judah and Benjamin, remember, 12 tribes, 10 are gone, 2 remain, Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites arose, even everyone whose spirit God had stirred to go up and rebuild the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. Again, make sure you see the language here. Who was stirred to go back to the land? Those whom God worked in their heart, who stirred them up, right? So God has sovereignly stirred Cyrus to issue the decree, and now he's stirring the right people among the Jews to respond and go back to the land. Now, we saw it last week, not all the Jews did. In fact, the majority of Jews did not return. And there are many reasons for that. Some would have just been too old to make that journey. By the way, map time. That's a 900-mile journey. Talk about getting your steps in. Okay? You can't go straight across the desert there. You'll die. So you got to go along the Euphrates River. So blue is Jerusalem, the red is Babylon. You've got to go along the Euphrates River around what we call the Fertile Crescent down through Syria into the land. That's how you get there, 900 miles. So if you're old, if you're infirmed, if you're disabled, that's probably not a journey you're going to be able to make. You will die along the way. So that's part of it. Others would have looked at this and said, not only is that a brutal journey filled with dangers, but when I get there, the condition of the land is going to be what? Desolate. How many of you guys would up and leave where you're living now and say, let's go to a super desolate place that's just been destroyed and squatters have moved in and we'll start building from scratch? That sounds great. Only people who were stirred up by the Lord were going to do that. Many said, no, thank you. Let's be honest. Many of the Jews were just comfortable in exile, right? In Babylon, in Persia, because they had built communities during the 70 years. They'd built synagogues, they had jobs, they had businesses, right? Some of the Jews had been in exile all their lives. They'd never even seen Jerusalem. They only heard their parents and grandparents talk about it. So why go back? They hadn't even seen it before. And yes, we can say with confidence that a percentage of the Jews in Babylon were just living in disobedience. They weren't practicing Judaism. They weren't participating in synagogue life. And they'd have no interest in going back because Judaism wasn't a reality in their day-to-day life. That's true as well. Now, I find this interesting. God is a God of order and balance. Remember, it took three waves of Jews leaving into exile. God ordains that the return of the land will also happen in three waves. Three waves out, three waves back. The first is described in Ezra chapters 1 through 6 under, and Yael set me straight on how to pronounce the name last week. Thank you. Zerubbabel. Not Zerubbabel, not Zerubbabel, Zerubbabel. Did I get it? I said to her last week, it's one thing to take seminary Hebrew, it's another to grow up speaking it, and so I'm going to defer to her. Talk to Yael afterwards, she'll get it right. Okay, so he returns with 50,000 Jews. That's the first return, okay? And when they arrive after months of travel, like you'd expect, things were not great. They get back to the land and the community pulls together and they build a foundation for a second temple. Great news, right? Only the people who had seen the first temple are super disappointed in it. It's much smaller, it's not impressive, and it says that those who had seen Solomon's temple are weeping because this temple is so unimpressive. And then they run into all kinds of opposition from their enemies. There's threats, and there's legal challenges, and there's discouragement. And Israel's enemies succeed. And this is sometimes confusing to us, right? Here we are, we put ourselves out there, we follow God's will, and all we do is bump into problems and opposition from God's enemies. And we start asking questions, well, why would this happen? We're doing God's will. But this is exactly what happens to the Jews. The enemies of God sort of prevail. Work stops on the temple for quite a few years. And then during that time, another enemy sets in, distraction. The people go, you know what? We can't get the temple done, so I'm going to go work on my own house. And I'm going to farm my land. I'm going to focus on myself. And suddenly the priority of the temple is completely gone. Well, God responds to that. In his mercy, he sends prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to shake the Jews out of their spiritual laziness. Start building the house of God, they say. And they do. They finish the temple in 516. The second temple is actually completed. Now, I'm going to show you one more timeline. This is where it gets interesting. Between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7, there's a long gap, 58-year gap. So I know this is a lot, but I'm going to put this up. There's a gap of 58 years. So 586 is the final exile into Babylon. 538 is the first return. Okay, 516, the second temple is finished. Ah, here's the book of Esther. We've finally gotten there. Esther begins before the second and third returns under Ezra and Nehemiah. The gap of 58 years is the same in both of those sections of time. So Esther is right in the center of all of this material. During that gap of 58 years, this is where all of these things we're going to read about over the next few months take place. The same amount of time, 58 years, had passed since the first return of the Jews to the land. And in spite of Esther and Mordecai having the freedom to go back to the land, they say what? No, thank you. I'm good here in Susa. They choose to remain. Now, go back in your mind. We read, if you want to look at it, Esther 2, verse 5. Remember, it refers to Mordecai as the great-grandson of a man named Kish. It was Kish who was taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar in 586. That means two generations of Mordecai's family after Kish had been raised in exile. His grandfather Shimei and his father Yair. So by then, look, exile was all Mordecai knew. And he was living relatively comfortably in the diaspora life. And we're going to find out that Mordecai is a little bit of a social climber. He becomes an official in the Persian royal court there in Susa. And so like most exiles, he and Esther were basically, they were living sort of a double life, citizens of two communities, one more hidden, their Jewish identity and community, and the other Persian. And what's interesting here is they'd taken on Persian names, and these are the names that are given to them throughout the book, and their names are interesting. Mordecai is the Hebraic form of the name Mardukah, which comes from the pagan god Marduk, who's the chief god, the patron god of the city of Babylon. And yet he's known as Mordecai, a Jew. Hadassah's Persian name Esther is likely based on an Akkadian word for star, which was Ishtar, which scholars believe is connected to, again, the fertility goddess Ishtar. So they've taken on these names that are definitely connected to Persian gods, to Babylonian gods, to pagan gods. So this is a possible sign that their desire was to assimilate with Persian culture rather than to stand out as Jews. Now you may look at that and go, I get it. Maybe they're doing this out of fear, or maybe they just prefer Persian culture. We're not given the answer to that question, but we should at least observe that this is true of them, right? It could also be that they just at this point in their lives, having been raised in exile, they have very little connection to Jewish practice, to Judaism as a whole. Maybe no connection at all to synagogue life. We don't know. But here's one of the things that makes the book of Esther stand out. Among all the post-exilic writings, this one thing stands out, and it's an unavoidable fact. It's the only book in the collection that has nothing to do with going back to the land. All the others do, all of them. Ezra and Nehemiah both have a single-minded agenda, rebuilding and reestablishing Jewish life in the land. Their hearts are there. Haggai and Zechariah are focused on motivating the Jews to rebuild the temple, to reestablish worship in the land. Even Daniel, although he is an official in the royal court, just like Mordecai is, his concern is still for the Jewish community in the land. But not Esther. This is important, but not Esther. It stands alone in its Jewish characters, Mordecai and Esther, not voicing any concern about Jerusalem, not any concern for the temple or for the Jewish exiles who 58 years before had gone back to the land. Not even curious about it, according to the narrative. So, as we wrap up, what can we say about Mordecai and Esther? What can we say about their identity and their faith? I said it earlier, we got to be careful we don't go too far because the narrative doesn't give us all the details. But because of the absence of anything related to Jerusalem, anything related to the temple, because of the absence of any appeal to Yahweh by name, the absence of prayer, the absence of a mention of Torah, because there's no description of either Mordecai or Esther participating in synagogue life or even just basic Jewish rituals, it's hard for the reader to come to the conclusion that these are practicing Jews. Cultural Jews, yeah. Practicing Jews, no. They're simply two people who are part of the diaspora, part of this religious minority community, focused on surviving in this foreign political context. Now, that's not to say that later in the story we're not going to see traits of humility and wisdom and faith and courage, things that we can emulate and admire. But my assessment of this, as I've been studying this for I don't know how many hours, is that Esther and Mordecai are very similar to so many people in America today who say, oh, I'm a Christian, but there's no evidence to actually prove that. We call them cultural Christians. And I think Esther and Mordecai are cultural Jews. Sure, they recognize their ethnicity as Jews who came from Jerusalem, but there's no evidence to show that they're practicing their faith. Now, as I wrap up, I don't want that to discourage you, because this is a historical narrative, and the reality of historical narrative is, you ready for this? I'm going to drop the bomb. Neither Esther or Mordecai are the main character in the story. God is. We have to remember that. God is the main character. And as we progress through this book, what we're going to see is God being sovereign, his providential hand working through the lives of Mordecai and Esther, not because they deserve it, not because they're godly Jews, but because of his mercy, because of his grace. That's the only reason. Amen? Okay. Last Sunday and today, we now have our foundation, right? I won't do this to you again, I promise. Let's bow our heads and pray. Blessed are you, Father, creator of heaven and earth. You are a good God, and you have blessed your people in so many ways. And we sit here today as your people in Santa Clarita, California, and we stand in awe of your goodness and your mercy. We are not that different from the characters in this story who at times, Lord, we just want to assimilate into our culture, and we don't show evidence or fruit of godly faith in our lives. So we are so grateful that you are merciful, that you are gracious to us. And even as you will not leave us or forsake us, you will not let us slip away. You continue to shower us and lavish us with your mercy and grace and hold on to us and continue to motivate us and encourage us by your Spirit to walk by faith. Lord, thank you for the lessons that we have learned already today and what we're going to learn in the future. Continue to seal these truths in our hearts as we seek to glorify you in our study. We love you. We praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.